Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Well, the Brexit drama saga continues with a further turn of events. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court ruled that UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's suspension of Parliament was unlawful. So what happens next? On the line to give her thoughts, we have our political commentator, Susan Phillips. You're very welcome back to the show, Susan. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Ronan.
So first, Susan, give us an overview of this turn of events. There was a three-day emergency hearing resulting in a unanimous judgment from 11 justices in the UK's highest court.
Yeah, it was unanimous, and that was surprising. But anyway, in the end, Boris Johnson's decision to suspend Parliament for the 5 weeks was found to be unlawful. So the Prime Minister, who obviously faced, you know, lots of calls to resign, he actually said, Ronan, he said he profoundly disagreed with the ruling, but he would respect it. So obviously, proroguing was provided to be unlawful, so the Commons reassembled. Now, I don't know if any of you or the listeners had a moment on Wednesday evening to tune into the actual Commons debate. But it was really, really ferociously,
it was fierce.
Yeah, angry, yeah. Scenes. Did you see it?
I couldn't stop watching it. I mean, I didn't want to watch it, but it was brutal, wasn't it?
It really was brutal. And you have to, I suppose, to be sort of decent, you'd say, well, Boris Johnson had come off a plane and he was facing Prime Minister question times. But the way the questions were sent to him was so angry and rude, and he was rude and angry back. And then later on, he was accused of using, I think it was called unsuitable provocative language, because he kept referring to that bill which makes him have to look for an extension. He calls it a surrender bill, and people kept saying, that's a very rude word.
Yeah.
In the end, you know, Boris, he didn't actually lose it, but you could say, as he hasn't got the numbers on his side, he probably should have leant over to the other side and been slightly plighter, shouldn't he?
I think that's putting it mildly. I was going to say, the language is also kind of like the language of war, isn't it? Like, they're using words like coup and surrender he didn't say traitor, but he did say betrayal. And that's kind of, it's triggering kind of language for certain people, isn't it?
Well, you are looking at a situation where the parties are divided, the opinions are divided. You're getting some, as you just said, some pretty provocative words. Even the bishops, did you see that? That the bishops released a joint statement, this is the British Christian bishops, to say that please would people on both sides of the debate start treating each other with greater respect. Now, I've never seen that happen before.
No, never. Never in my lifetime have I ever seen that. The idea that, you know, was it the Leader of the House said something like, we are not enemies, we are opponents, or something like that. I can't remember.
Yes, it said, don't be enemies, be opponents. That's what it said.
Yeah.
But you see, it's quite interesting because the Queen's speech, this is what really nobody knows, it was meant to be the 14th, and before you do that, 14th of October, and the run-up to the Queen's speech has to be a prorogue. You have to give space for everybody to decide what they'd like to hear her say, which is the excuse that Boris always used. Now Parliament are back sitting, everybody's saying, well, if the poor Queen is to give her speech on the 14th of October, does Parliament have to prorogue for a few days first?
And you'd imagine so, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Sorry, I interrupted you there. Please go on.
No. So, in fact, does she think she's going to speak on the 14th, or doesn't she? And in the meantime, you've got Jean-Claude Juncker, who's making, you know, he's sort of enjoying his last few weeks in the seat, and he's doing the blame game, and he's saying that, you know, Britain would be solely to blame for a no deal if, you know, there is nothing can be hammered out, and Brussels are doing their absolute best, and, you know, he's sort of saying it's all the fault of the British if there's no deal. And on the other side, as we know, Boris is saying he'd rather be dead in a ditch than have to ask for an extension, which by law he's actually forced to do.
And am I right in saying, so I overheard something the other day that he just was asked directly, will you ask for a deal, and he just simply said no.
Yes. So then what happens is he jailed?
I don't know.
Of course, what everybody's looking for is a general election. But you see, the Labour Party have been backed by the SNP and the Liberal Dems, and they've been so crafty. They haven't said we want an election. They've got the numbers to call an election, Ronan.
They do.
But they don't want one, because at the moment the polls are showing that Boris Johnson would probably get in quite well. That's if he doesn't fall out with the Brexit Party, or, you know, there isn't a division of votes. So it's quite interesting to see that Corbyn knows at the moment that after a disastrous party conference, I mean, it really was disastrous, where the Labour Party has shown themselves, and maybe people like it, but they've shown themselves to be very radically placed on the left, very divided. They're discussing that private ownership and private education must be abolished. You know, it's quite dangerous times, isn't it? And so the theory is that a general election would go the way of the Tories, but the other parties have the power not to call one.
Yeah, it's really... I mean, as it's amazing actually just having you describing what happened this week and going, it was only Tuesday that that ruling came out, and it feels like about 6 months ago because so much has happened since. And I'm listening to you going, it really sounds like an awful mess, really, doesn't it?
Well, the biggest hope, and I actually do have a bit of hope, which is good, the biggest hope that there could be some sort of backstop deal whereby there is only an all-Ireland backstop. As being a solution. Now, the British side say that they've moved on the issue of regulation by agreeing to perhaps an all-Ireland zone for agri-food, you know, the cattle yes. coming over and the milk going back. And that would be a huge start, wouldn't it? So that would take up the reasons that you wouldn't need to have a border for the daily issues. Now, on the bigger issues, the industrial issues, apparently nobody could work out how they could do it, because if Northern Ireland is to be of no problem in this deal, it has to remain in the customs union, and the DUP say we're British and we're not going to be treated differently. But there has been that little opening on the agricultural side, and who's to say, maybe it could open up wider.
Yeah, absolutely. And is your feeling that the DUP might be something convenient for them, kind of to get themselves out of jail a little bit by saying, well, if we come to some sort of arrangement whereby, you know, our constitutional position as British is guaranteed, but we managed to climb down some of these, you know, they were very, very, very hard red lines. And of course, the DUP generally don't climb down from those kind of positions. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, the people who vote for the DUP are suddenly going, hang on a second here, we could be out of business.
They really are saying that. I think the DUP realised that if there's an absolutely messy crash out in the EU would make the South put up a border, that the DUP would look so messy. I think they would be really down on their luck if they do that. And I think they realise that. I think that they've simply got to give somewhere. And don't forget, people in the North, they've all voted to remain. The farmers, who are big, you know, landowners, who are all sort of unionists, they're saying, we don't agree with the DUP at the moment. You've got to give a little.
Yeah, so they really do need some sort of an arrangement where they can not lose face and yet kind of do a little bit of a U-turn there. Can I just ask you very quickly before I let you go, your own feeling? I was talking earlier on about this situation what's going on in Washington with Donald Trump and Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Can you give us a little bit of an idea
I
what
can,
your feelings are?
Because don't forget that Nancy Pelosi is a Democrat. She's Speaker of the House of Representatives, and she's initiated impeachment proceedings against President Trump, and the complaint relates to a phone call between President Trump and the Ukraine's President Zelensky back in July. And apparently he was talking and saying, yes, we do agree the Ukraine needs more American financial aid. And the inference is that he said on the phone to the President, if you don't give me some information that you're digging into the happenings of Joe Biden's son, who was actually on a board in the Ukraine at the time of President Obama's reign, America will delay giving you your funding. Now, of course, President Trump absolutely denies that, and perhaps the recordings will show, but at the moment we've had a summary of the telephone call. But in addition, Nancy Pelosi is saying that the complaint that whoever this whistleblower is, some intelligence officer apparently, that apparently they've also learned that senior White House officials have intervened to lock down the recording of that phone call. And the final thing is, who is the whistleblower? Nobody knows. Are they hand in glove with one of the Democratic potentials for next year's election? We do not know. And the other thing is that Donald Trump said, tweeted, this is the greatest scam in the history of American politics, and no American president has ever been treated in this way.
Right, so yeah.
You would have to say that, true or untrue, he is treated to a huge amount of really difficult stuff, isn't he?
He certainly is. And you know, I think, again, like as somebody just emailed or texted us earlier on, you know, being in possession of an unfortunate personality can sometimes mean that you really get hammered for things.
It doesn't help. And then the final thing is that impeachment has to go through both houses. Now, it probably fairly easily, it'll go through the House of Representatives because that's Democrat on top. But if it goes up to the Senate, it won't get through. I mean, don't forget that President Clinton was impeached by the House. Do you remember that?
I do remember it well. Yeah,
it was story in all 1998.
Yes.
And that did not get through the Senate. So in the end, it was all dropped.
In a way, it actually helped his re-election because people felt like he'd been picked on. And you kind of think,
absolutely,
well, maybe something similar might happen. Yeah.
People are saying exactly the same things. They're saying that the Democrats could be shooting themselves in the foot. Mm. And furthermore, nobody's actually jumped to the defense of the son of Joe Biden, because apparently he was on the board of some big company out there which is being investigated.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's a really watch this space kind of a thing, because it's been such a dramatic week. I'm sure there's more drama to come. Listen, thank you for opening up some of those issues for us there, Susan. Always a pleasure to speak with you, and we'll talk to you again soon. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Rin.
Now, this Sunday, the 29th of September, is World Heart Day, and Ireland's historic Rock of Cashel in Cashel County, Tipperary, and Dublin City Hall will light up red to mark the occasion. And our next guest is on the line to give us her top tips for a healthy heart. On the line now to tell us more, we have Maurice Damery, Health Check Manager with the Irish Heart Foundation. You're very welcome to the show, Maurice. How are you?
Hi, Ronan. Thanks a million for having us on today. You're right. We're hoping that we can encourage people to have healthier hearts and do things that helps make their heart healthy.
Brilliant.
Especially in the lead up to World Heart Day on Sunday.
Can I just ask you, Maurice, why is it important that we look after our hearts? I mean, what are the possible health implications of not looking after your heart, shall we say?
There are so many things that help you look after your heart in terms of being more physically active, being a healthy weight, drinking less alcohol, not smoking, and trying to look after your stress levels as well. If you have high blood pressure, it can put damage on your blood vessels, and after a period of time, that puts you at risk of stroke and heart disease or heart attack.
Sure.
So we really encourage people to look after their blood pressure and also their cholesterol as well. And we find also when people aren't as active, you know, this in effect can have an effect on your heart as well and on the heart muscle, and leads also to weakness in the blood vessels. So again, that as well increases your risks of heart disease and stroke. But there's so many things we can all do to reduce this risk. And we know that actually 80% of cardiovascular disease, heart disease and stroke is preventable by making positive lifestyle changes. So we just really encourage people to make those changes, and that in turn will help improve your heart health.
So can I just ask you, I mean, obviously increasingly over the last number of years, I mean, I've been doing these interviews for a good number of years now at this stage, and it seems like the stroke thing has come much more to the fore. You know, initially there was talking about heart attack, and there was talking about, you know, that kind of that end of things. But stroke really is something that seems to have, is it that we've become much more aware of the implications for stroke? Is that what's happened?
I think what's happened, unfortunately, in Ireland, and in fact there was a recent study, and I don't want to be talking about too much around statistics, I want to talk more around lifestyle, but
sure,
in fact what has happened in Ireland is that we've become the second worst country, unfortunately, in terms of managing our blood pressure levels.
Wow,
out of a study of 12 major countries.
Gosh.
We're the second there that have the highest hypertension, high blood pressure levels going on through the 12 countries.
And Maurice, is that to do with people not taking their meds, or is it just not knowing that they should be taking meds in the first place, or is it something else?
Really, I suppose it's because what we do notice is the countries that are doing well and managing their blood pressure levels, more of those countries have proper screening systems in place.
Okay.
And routine blood pressure checks. So I think what we really need here in Ireland is to have a little bit more of a system where having your blood pressure checked becomes more of a routine, particularly over the age of 30. Blood pressure in Ireland has increased, and they say by 2020 we'll have 1.2 million people in Ireland with high blood pressure.
Wow.
And why I'm talking about blood pressure, I suppose, as well, is that is the major risk for stroke.
Yeah.
So if blood pressure is going up, then more people will be having strokes. And we know that actually at the moment, 1 in 4 people, working age people, are having stroke in their lifetime. So really, that's why you're hearing a little bit more about stroke. And we're really trying to raise that awareness. And with that, we talk a lot around blood pressure and encourage people to have a blood pressure check. And in fact, we do free blood pressure checks through our mobile health unit that travels the country. And we really encourage people to come forward and have a free blood pressure check. Now, what we're doing on the day is really looking at people who are at risk.
Yeah.
And so if you came along to the mobile health unit on the day, we do your blood pressure. We would then advise you onto your GP if your blood pressure was elevated on the day.
Yeah.
So it's a once-off check. But we do encourage people, apart from having it done with us, they might have it done in their local pharmacy or when they're going to their GP. So make it opportunistic. If you have a chance to have a blood pressure check, have it done. And if you're in your GP surgery, maybe ask the GP if they could do it as well.
Can I just say as well, like, I'm one of them, you know? I'm one of the people with that blood pressure issue. But the weird thing was, every time I went to get my blood pressure checked, it was absolutely fine. Constantly told. And it was getting so bad, I was hearing something in my ears. And eventually I said, look, is there any way? And my GP said, well, actually, we could give you a 24-hour monitor. Yeah. And sure enough, 3 o'clock in the morning, screaming high blood pressure that they would never have caught. Yeah. So I'm just wondering, is that something, do you think, is that normal? Or is that something that, am I unusual
little,
in that way?
It's probably a little bit more unusual, but there is a thing, and it is called masked hypertension, where we can do somebody's blood pressure and it isn't up at the time. So that's why I'd say having a once-off blood pressure check is not enough.
Sure.
You know, so if people come to a mobile health unit, that's great. It's brilliant that they do come. If it's not up in the day, you know, it's not to scare people, but what I mean to say is that if it's not up in the day, it doesn't mean you're not going to be at risk down the road. You should still be having it checked again and again.
Sure.
And actually, 24-hour monitoring is the gold standard in terms of diagnosing high blood pressure. Okay. We would encourage people to have
that
done.
Yeah, yeah.
So there if you're worried,
like yours,
there's white coat syndrome as well. Do you know what I mean? Where somebody can come to a surgery and their blood pressure is very high because they're anxious or nervous about it. The white coat, the doctor thing.
So I was obviously the opposite.
But at the same time, it was great that you did go, and it was great that you had the 24-hour monitoring, then we encourage people to take the medication and go on medication.
Maurice, you wanted to talk about lifestyle, so I'm thinking, you know, healthy eating, or exercise, or sleep, or what are you talking, all three, or what?
This month, actually, in particular, we have a campaign around being more physically active. So we encourage people to be more active in the workplace and in the community. So that would be like, the campaign is actually called Escape Your Chair. People can have a look on our website.
Yeah,
Escape Your Chair, irishheart.ie. And the reason we've called it Escape Your Chair is because we find that people are, you know, sitting 7.5 hours a day, maybe in offices, which is half their waking hours.
Gosh.
So we're trying to, say to people, escape your chair, go over to your colleague, have a chat with them about what you want to talk about instead of sending an email, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, take the stairs instead of the lift. Walk over to the water cooler every so often during the day, get your water, that type of thing. So it's kind of like just being a little bit more active within your day.
Sure.
Because, you know, even if you're going to the gym in the evening and you're working out for an hour, that doesn't quite negate, you know, not doing anything during the day, you know, for those 7.5 hours if you're sitting, you know. So just encouraging people to be a little bit more and to more active and to think about that moving around.
I was surprised, Maurice, that actually getting a good night's sleep is actually important for heart health.
Yeah, it is. And getting more sleep, you know, having enough sleep in the night is very important. And I suppose one of the things that can lead to lack of sleep sometimes is stress, you know. So we'd really, you know, again, there's encouraging people, and they're kind of common sense things, you know, in terms of, you know, take a little walk in the evening, maybe walk with a friend, actually, because sometimes that can be a real stress buster. You know, you're walking with your friend, you're having a chat about things that might be causing you stress during the day, and that in itself can help make you sleep better in the evening. And I think there are things like, as well, as we all know, about putting that mobile phone away, you know, maybe not looking at things like that, that activate your brain before you go to sleep,
such
you relax.
Get away from your screens. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
And when I'm taking exercise, it's, you know, a little bit puffed, a little bit out of breath, yeah?
When you're taking when you're being physically active, yeah, we say 30 minutes a day, so you're huffing, not puffing.
Yeah, huffing, not puffing,
flowing,
I like it, yeah.
Flowing.
Very good, yeah.
And, you know, you're not feeling yourself over pumping as well. So it's kind of that moderate activity at a moderate level as well. So kind of, and that can be a real stress buster.
So 30 minutes a day gives you what, kind of 3.5 hours a week, that kind
say
of stuff?
30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. But again, you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, you could be sitting down, you know, in the office or watching television. Outside of that, you need to be moving around a little bit more,
and
then maybe drinking less alcohol.
Yes, very good.
You know, we say for men, you know, 17 standard drinks a week, and for women 11, but they're not targets, you know. We're not encouraging people to drink that level of alcohol.
Sure.
You know, and not to drink at all in the one go, obviously, you know, that binge drinking is not healthy for us at all, so to try and spread it out and drink water and have alcohol-free days as well.
So Sunday is the day, the World Heart Day, and the theme for this year's awareness campaign is My Heart, Your Heart, I believe. Could you tell us a bit about that?
We in ourselves in the Irish Heart Foundation, as I say, in the lead up to World Heart Day, are doing a Heart Hero 5K walk in parks. So encouraging people to go to their local park runs, and they can do a park run or a park walk. Now for this, if they like, these walks are free, the park run, but they can also register on a website to do the Heart Hero 5K in the lead up to World Heart Day. And they can get a t-shirt from the Irish Heart Foundation as well. For this, they pay a fee of €20. But if people don't want to, register with us, they can also still go to the park run anyway, because what we really are encouraging in the lead up to World Heart Day is for people to move more and sit less.
That's wonderful. Maurice, thank you so much for joining us today. Maurice, that's Maurice Damery, Health Check Manager with the Irish Heart Foundation. Thank you so much for talking to
us.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Owen. Take care.
Thank you.
And to celebrate World Heart Day 2019, the Irish Heart Foundation has organised a Heart Hero 5K, as Maurice was just saying, in association with Park Run Ireland on Saturday, September the 28th, 2019. And if you want to check it out, go to www.irishheart.ie. There are not many people in the world that can say they were childhood friends with John Lennon, and even fewer that can say they were in a band with him. A band that eventually became the Beatles. Our next guest is an original member of the band The Quarrymen, which you might be aware eventually became the band The Beatles. In studio now to tell us more and to perform live for us, we have musician Rod Davis. You are very, very welcome to the show, Rod. How are you?
Thank you. Good morning.
First of all, Rod, we are delighted that you're in studio to play live music for us ahead of your upcoming show in Dublin, which we'll chat about shortly. But will we kick off with the song?
If you like.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Shall we just do that and let's hear. What's this called, first of all?
Well, how about Midnight Special?
Oh, yeah. Brilliant. Perfect.
Wake pearly in the morning, hear the ding-dong ring. Go walk to the table, see the same darn thing. Night fucker on the table, nothing in my pen. But if I complain about it, I'm in trouble with the man on the midnight special. Shine light on me on that midnight special. Shine a devil loving light on me. If you ever go to Houston, why, you better walk right, and you better not stagger, and you better not fight, cause the sheriff will arrest you. He'll carry you down. If the jury find you guilty, you're penitentiary bound on the midnight special. Shine a light on me on that midnight special. Shine a devil loving light on me. Yonder comes Miss Rosie. How in the world do you know? I can tell her by her apron and the dress she wore, umbrella on the shoulder, piece of paper in her hand. Waltz right up to my captain, said, please release my man on the midnight special. Shine a light on me on that midnight special. Shine a devil loving light on me. I've done my time, boys. I've been weeping and crying, and a man's gonna call me. I'll be riding down the line on the midnight special. Shine a light on me on that midnight special. Shine a tender loving light on me.
Woo! Rod Davis and Midnight Special. Can I just get a muso-y just for a second with you, Rod? I often think about, you know, the way rock and roll kind of took over the kind of southern states of the United States and really just swept in just a couple of years. And yet I've so little insight into what it must have been like to hear Skiffle for the first time and gone, Lonnie Donegan doing his thing. Was that really like a really fresh new sound to somebody who was like in their teens in the 50s?
Absolutely. I was sitting in the back of my dad's car. We'd gone to St. Helens Market, which is 10, 15 miles outside Liverpool. And I was 14 years old. I was sitting in the back of the car and we were outside a record shop. And the door was open and they were playing Rock Island Line. This must have been January 56.
Yeah.
When it started to climb up the hit parade. It was a hit parade in those days. It wasn't a chart.
Sure, sure.
And it, you know, it changed my life forever. Absolutely.
Yeah. You knew where you were. Like, even the fact that you can just there catch that moment of going, I heard it.
And,
I was like,
and of course, it had the same effect on loads of other people as well. You know, thousands of youngsters all over Britain and Ireland, indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just extraordinary.
It was, there was something quintessentially English and yet rock and roll about it. It kind of had something that really caught the kind of zeitgeist at the time.
Well, I mean, I've been thinking hard about this. I mean, there were quite a lot of sort of American-ish, you know, Western rootsy stuff around.
Sure.
I mean, there was stuff like, you know, Frankie Lane's Cool Water, 16 Tons, The Man from Laramie, that kind of
thing. Yeah, yeah.
But it was very, very schmaltzy, really. Whereas Skiffle was very much earthier.
It was edgy. Yeah.
And edgy, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm delighted to even meet you. It's such a pleasure and an honour. So take us back to the early years. Were you always, I'm getting the feeling you were always interested in music, like the fact that you could be, like, you know, animated by hearing something that's playing in the street.
Well,
or something good.
I started off with piano lessons, and I was taught by a very old lady with a moustache.
Did she bang the back of your hand?
No. She was actually very nice. The room was lit by gaslight. So my brother says, "Oh, we learned piano by gaslight." it was things like flower waltzes and stuff. I always wanted my mum to let me put drawing pins in the hammers, because Winifred Atwell was very popular at the time, and when she'd say, "I'm now going to my other piano and start playing all this honky-tonk stuff," I thought that was great.
The tack piano, they used to call it.
I used to play duets with my younger brother. He played the left hand, I played the right hand, and we used to argue about who played the bum note. And my mother got so sick of the arguments, she sold the piano. So that was my early musical career, basically.
That's the end of that, lads.
Yeah, we tried a bit of recorder at school, and then, you know, then I rather fancied the clarinet, but clarinets were expensive. So
sure.
That was the end of that, until the Quarrymen came along. And
did you pick up the guitar first? Was it the bass? What was the washboard bass, or whatever, not the washboard bass.
T-chest bass. Because Alani Donegan was played in the rhythm section of a jazz band, he played banjo.
Yeah.
And he actually played guitar chords on the banjo, because he wasn't a banjo player. He played guitar. I know this from his own lips.
Sure.
He was really a guitar player. But it meant that if you bought a banjo or a guitar, that was good enough, you know, for Donegan. And so I acquired a banjo from a friend of a relation who used to play in a dance band in North Wales. And I went to school and said, I bought a banjo yesterday. My friend said, do you want to be in a group?
Wow.
Who's in the group? And, well, I was in the same year as John Lennon at Quarry Bank, and I'd known John since I was about five. So it sounded good to me. So that's how I started. It was as simple as that.
And so what was that first meeting with, not with John, but with the Quarrymen? How did that all come about?
Well, a friend, another guy at school, a fellow called George Lee, said to John, I know this because I've spoken to George about it only 2-3 years ago, he said, "John, your voice is much better than a lot of these people singing skiffle on radio. Why don't you start your own skiffle group?" So I said to George, why weren't you in the skiffle group then? He said, "Well, I had a guitar, but I couldn't play it." So he actually lent it to John. So John then persuaded his mate Pete Shotton to play the washboard, because Pete has said, "Oh, I haven't got a musical bone in his body," but he was a good washboard player. And so it was just a matter of gathering a couple of mates from the same year at school. He had a guitar player, another guitar player, Eric Griffiths, and a guy on the T-chest bass, Bill Smith. And John Eric went to a guitar teacher to get a few lessons, but the man was trying to teach him to play the guitar properly, i.e. from the dots.
Oh.
And they quickly realised that this was going to take forever.
Sure.
So after two lessons, they jacked it in and complained to John's mother, and she said, "Well, look, if you tune your guitar like a banjo and play the top four strings, don't worry about the bottom two, just let them, you know, drift around in the breeze, then the banjo chords I show you will work."
Yeah.
So that's what they did. So when I turned up, I actually had a banjo, so I was playing the correct chords for the instrument, whereas John and Eric were playing banjo chords on the guitar. Right,
yeah.
The opposite of Donegan, who played guitar chords on the banjo.
Wow, that's wild.
By a strange coincidence.
Wow. Victoria, just who's producing the item, mentioned that Pete Shotton had a funniest story about John, about doing religious knowledge.
Well, I was never in the same class as John. I was in the same classroom twice a day because we were in the same house. So I don't have to explain houses to Irish.
Yeah.
When you go to America, you're in the same house. That's, you have to spend 15 minutes explaining what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But so I wasn't actually present when this happened. But the scripture teacher was a man called Mr. McDermott. And John and Pete were chatting about this, and one of them said, he's never going to be happy unless he's got a complete classroom full of vicars, you see. So Pete's mum had a grocer's shop, and they poked around in the back of the grocer's shop and found some old Weetabix packets or something like that, and made 32 dog collars out of cardboard. So they got to the lesson a bit early and handed out 32 dog collars to all the class, and they all were sitting there trying to suppress laughter, and then McDermott walks in, sits down at his desk, probably looking at the register or something, and doesn't notice this. Then he looks up and sees a whole classroom full of vicars. And he just broke up. I mean, that was brilliant.
It's brilliant, doesn't it?
A lot of John's stuff was brilliant.
Clever.
A lot of it was just disruptive, right?
Yeah,
so that was one of the good ones.
Yeah. Brilliant. So what kind of venues were you playing? Because, I mean, you were kind of like a schoolboy band, really, at that stage.
We were just a bunch of kids.
Hard enough to find places to play. So what kind of places were you playing?
Well, we played at the local youth club a few times. We played at the odd birthday party. The skiffle contests were all the rage, you know. Everybody would go there, and the judges, by the time they'd heard Rock Island Line and Worried Man Blues about 30 times,
probably
went nuts. And we'd also play in the interval for dances, you know.
Yeah.
You'd have a conventional band doing waltzes and quick steps, and then a skiffle group in the interval where people were allowed to jive.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, cheap dances had records in the interval, and I still hate dancing to records. I hate discos.
Yeah.
Because a live band is
it's just not the same as
a record.
So, Rod, what led to you leaving the band, or did you leave?
Well, I was a banjo player, and I was more interested in the bluesy, rootsy end of the repertoire, and the rest of them were going to the rock and roll. So rock and roll was, coming in fast, and the people who'd learned three chords for skiffle could play rock and roll, and I thought it was exploitative, Tim Panelli, trite rubbish.
That's musical differences, then, is it?
Musical differences. Well, as a band, you can't have a banjo player in front of a rock and roll band, can you, really? I drifted out because it was the end of the fifth year at school, and I was staying on to the sixth form to try and get into university. So basically, the quarrymen left me rather than me leaving the quarrymen, because John and Eric, who were at, and Pete Shotton, all left at the end of July 57. So I think I was surprised later on to find that they'd continued playing, to be honest. But it didn't bother me. I went out and bought a guitar and started playing bluesy stuff. So
yeah, and you followed your dream. And would Paul have come in kind of as you departed? Is that the way it worked?
Well, on the 6th of July, 57, which was the day John and Paul met, strolling home that night, John said to Pete, this is totally contrary to John's story that said he immediately recognised Paul's talent and invited him to join the band. No, total hogwash. They were walking home late that night, and John said to Pete, what do you reckon on on this McCartney guy? Pete says, yeah, he's pretty good. John says, do you think we should get him to join the group? So Pete says, yeah, sort of thing. So nothing happened then for a couple of weeks, and Pete was walking through his out of his front door down the front garden path, and who comes cycling past on his bike but Paul McCartney going to meet his friend Ivan Vaughan, who lived 100 yards up the road from Pete. And they started to chat, and Pete says, well, we were thinking of asking you to join the Quarrymen. What do you reckon, kind of thing? So Pete tells me that Paul sort of,
Yeah, okay.
Really?
So,
wow.
That was it.
On
and
such things, history has changed.
Something like that. So,
yeah.
Between the 6th of July and the end of July, I remember practicing at John's Aunt Mimi's house, the only time I ever remember practicing at Mimi's. And our friends would frequently turn up to listen to us practice, and sometimes they'd bring one or two girlfriends along, you know, that you could have somebody to bounce it off, you know, they thought that was great, yeah. Or, you know. And I walked in, and there was this lad I didn't know, and I said, "Oh, who's this, John?" He said, "Oh, that's Paul. He's come to listen to us practice." Okay. So that was it. That was my entire conversation with Paul McCartney until 2005. quite clearly, they were expecting to leave, and obviously didn't really want a banjo player in the group.
Absolutely.
And they didn't want a washboard player in the group.
Yeah.
They had to keep a TGS bass player in the group because they didn't have an electric bass. You
know? Yeah, absolutely.
So that was it.
So, was there any sense that you had? I mean, obviously, you had no connection really with Paul, but was there any sense from John that he had that kind of the kind of talent that he would display later on? Was there any sense of that?
Well, I usually answer that question by saying he was a brilliant caricaturist, which he was.
Which he continued to be.
Which he continued to be. And he could have made a, you know, he was Gerald Scarf quality practically, you know?
Yeah.
But he could front the band, or the group. It was never a band, it was always a group. He was up there in front, and he did a good job, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have known an international rock star, you know, if he wanted to hit me on the head.
Sure,
basically.
Exactly. How are you going to know these things? And as William Goldman said, he was talking about movies, but I often think it works with music as well, as nobody knows anything. You can never foretell what's going to happen.
Gonna happen.
You know?
Indeed,
look, no. I really, really enjoyed hearing you play, Rod. It's such a good buzz. Can you tell us a little bit about what people can expect at your upcoming gig?
Well, I'll be telling the same stories that I've been telling you, but with embroidery.
Yes, of course.
A lot more stories. The story of you know, how Skiffle came about, how the Quarrymen came about, this, that, and the other. How we played at the Cavern and all this kind of stuff. And then when a song comes up in the story, then I pick up the guitar and play the song. And of course, all this time I'm doing digital slide projection with various photographs on the backdrop, you know, so it'll with a bit of luck, you know, not too many people are going to fall asleep, especially if I turn up the amp to 11, you know.
Absolutely.
That should keep them awake.
Absolutely. It should be really wonderful evening. So Lost Lane, Dublin, which is just off Grafton Street, this Sunday, September the 29th, doors at 3 p.m. And show, as Rod has just said, involves, you know, as the song goes, raised in songs and stories. That's it, songs and stories. And I believe the support is John Ward. That's an acoustic Beatles cover, which is a great idea. How can we find out more information? How can people book tickets?
Well, it's
over to Paddy.
Lost Lane itself.
Lost Lane itself, great, okay.
And Lost Lane.
So it's lostlane.ie.
Yeah,
lostlane.ie, great, okay. So, musician Rod Davis, thank you so much for talking to us this morning. It's been an absolute joy meeting you and talking with you.
You're very welcome. It's been fun. Thank you.
Ireland had a great start to the Rugby World Cup on Sunday against Scotland, and they will have to do it all over again tomorrow against hosts Japan if they want to keep the momentum going. In studio now to look back at an exciting first week, as well as forward to tomorrow's game, we have our very own Steve Johnson. How are you doing there, Steve?
Great, Ronan.
Yeah.
Of course, it's Rugby World Cup time. Why wouldn't you be great?
He'd be the light of himself. First of all, Steve, did you see the game on Sunday?
Well, I was actually away.
Yes.
I was in Italy, so
lucky
I'd flown
fella.
In the night before, and so I didn't have my bearings at all. I switched on the telly, you know, praying that they'd be showing the game, and they were showing the Italian game.
Yes, of course.
Italy,
yeah.
But not the Ireland one. So I had to then go wandering the streets, and it was a very funny experience because I was wandering the streets looking for a pub that was open that might be showing and my kids were sending me WhatsApp saying, "Oh, we're 7-0, oh, we're 12-0 and I was starting to go, maybe I shouldn't watch this because this is actually going quite nicely. Maybe I should just keep
not
it that
watching
way
it. Exactly.
And eventually I found a place that had agreed to an English pub called Black Cat, and it had been persuaded by a dairy man to open up early and switch on the telly, so I got to see the second half.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant.
And I've since I got home, I've looked up the RT player and looked back on the first half. Yeah. I looked at it, my speakers weren't working, so I looked at it in silence, and in a way I was glad because, gosh, it was physical.
It was physical. You know, I always say, you know, the one thing that you can always depend on the Scots to do is to beat you up, but in this case, it was probably, we were probably given as good as we got, maybe even better.
Well, I really think that Scotland have an issue. They can beat anyone in the world at home.
Yeah.
But their record away is really not great, and unfortunately for them, that continued. Fortunately for us, but unfortunately for them, that continued in this neutral venue in Japan, where we really bossed it.
And we kind of took route one right up the middle, and they seemed to be trying to do flashy stuff, but they hadn't really kind of... They didn't really do the proper stuff well, stuff well.
They were trying the flashy stuff on a shaky foundation, and so they were getting caught, you know, when they were trying to flash the ball out, they were getting caught with big hits, and we just seemed to be a step ahead of them.
Yeah.
And really punished them then, but by putting points on the board, so it was a very, very tough day at the office for Scotland.
Now, reading Scotland and reading the people in Scotland, they seem to feel like, well, look, we didn't really turn up. So does that mean that instead of looking to Scotland as the second seed in the group, that really Japan are like the second seed?
Well, we'll know tomorrow. We'll know tomorrow. No, I think Ireland really prepared very well, and I think we can trust the Irish coaching setup to have looked beyond the first game and to have done their homework.
Which we haven't done. Yeah, we haven't always done. Like, remember Australia? We were amazing at the last World Cup, and it was incredible. We did that kind of choke tackle thing where we wouldn't let them fall over, and they weren't expecting it. But then by the second game, they hadn't
thought through, you know, how to beat an old enemy in a quarter final.
Exactly.
But I think that we have done our homework, and I think. Personally, I think this could be hugely significant, is that 2 years ago, when the eyes of the rugby world were watching the Lions, including a lot of our own guys down in New Zealand, quietly away, Joe Schmidt, with his new young guns, was in Japan, playing two tests against Japan, and kind of blooded a whole lot of new players, got them exposed to the thing. One of the games, the first test was played in Shizuoka, which is where tomorrow's game was played, so a lot of these guys played there.
Yeah.
So I think that's all kind of part of the long-term preparation that's been going on. Now, I know there's been a fair bit of turnover of players since then, but I think there'll be a big group of players, and I think it's great because it'll be some of the younger players will actually be telling the Lions, you know, telling Johnny Sexton, you know, and guys like Tadhg Furlong, this is what you need to know because I've been here before, you know. So I think that's great and should help a lot. Of course, the Japanese team will be a lot different to it was 2 years ago because they really have, you know, put huge efforts and preparations into this, so they'll be very good, very well drilled. Joe Schmidt was, you know, who always does his homework, was saying the Japan team have spent 180 to 200 days in camp together. They've invested a lot of time in each other to create the combinations that they are so effectively now showing. So
they were pretty impressive last weekend.
And he will show them plenty of respect. The way that Gerry Thornley says is that, you know, Japan have made no secret of their intention to stop the momentum of Irish carriers by double tackling them. You know, they know they're not physically as big as the Irish forwards, so they have got some big lads.
Yeah.
And also to attack on the edges. It's something we don't do, but the likes of Argentina did to us, going out very wide and attacking the edges. We don't actually like doing that, because the danger of attacking the edges is you actually get shoved into touch and turn over the ball. So it's almost a no-go zone when we're attacking.
Yeah.
You'll see a winger will very rarely, an Irish winger will very rarely try to beat someone on the outside along the touch line, but Japan will.
Exactly. What have we learned in terms of the first week? What can we say? Like, we've seen pretty much everyone play now at this stage.
Yeah, we have. So I think we've seen a lot because there are a lot of very big games, very important games happened early on. In my opinion, I think it shows that there are five contenders to win the World Cup.
Okay.
That's my own opinion.
And who are they, in your opinion?
So they would be South Africa, New Zealand, Ireland, Wales and England.
Okay.
And I think maybe the outside dark horses would be France, Argentina, and Australia.
Yeah.
I suppose we'll see a lot this weekend when Australia play against Wales on Sunday. Yeah. That's a really big game.
Yeah.
But that's my opinion. In terms of to win a World Cup, you've got to, you know, put a lot of big performances back to back. And I don't think the likes of France, Argentina, or Australia can do that.
Yeah.
That's my own opinion, but those other teams can. Unfortunately, I've mentioned five teams. Only four of them can get to a semi-final.
Exactly.
And the collision course is us, us with South Africa, in that first quarter final, if everything else goes according to plan.
That we, the way we expect it to.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's New Zealand, right? If we come
otherwise
second
it's
in the
New
group.
Zealand if we come second in the group, yeah,
who,
that's right.
And who wants that in a quarter?
Who wants
final?
That? Well, who wants either of them?
Exactly. Neither of them are great option.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I was saying, so in terms of things went more or less according to plan, I was tipping, you know, maybe the team for an upset this week was Fiji. I thought they might turn over Australia. And in a way, I was right because Fiji have been involved in the one upset, but it's the other way around. They played their second game midweek and lost to Uruguay while they were possibly on course to beat Australia, but a refereeing decision went against them, and they lost a player through an injury, and the guy who tackled him was later found to have deserved a red card but didn't get that red card. So they've
very
been
unfortunate.
Very unfortunate this week. They're actually not completely out of it, because if Wales beat Australia and then Fiji beat Wales, you know, they could they could still squeak through. And Fiji play lovely rugby. Everyone loves them.
It's
everyone adopts them as their second team. So it's unfortunate that they've really fortunes have not gone with them this week.
So it's playing host nation. I mean, it's just going to be the most partisan crowd ever. It's an enormous do you reckon there'll be 17 Irish people there?
Well, I think these will be lovers of rugby.
Yeah, okay.
And I've heard that, you know, there's lots of Japanese wearing All Blacks jerseys, you know, and so they are excited about seeing the best rugby players in the world playing here. So I think the last time we played against the host nation in the World Cup, boy, was that partisan. That was against France in 2007.
Oh, yeah.
Not only was it partisan when we played France, but every team, we were the team that, to beat in that group.
Yeah.
And so every time we played anyone else, including, you remember, Georgia, the whole of France was screaming for Georgia.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's going to be like that. I think, obviously there will be huge support for Japan, and there'll be great momentum behind them, particularly if they push ahead, but I don't think it'll be hostile.
That's
own opinion.
Yeah.
I've looked as well at the pitch has a running track, so I don't think it's going to be a cauldron. You know,
exactly.
Not have the
There's
crowd
distance,
right on top of
distance away from the crowd
of people, but they will have, you know, huge advantage playing at home.
Absolutely, and they're not half bad.
They're not half bad. I'm sort of half hoping that they will see this isn't their last chance saloon.
Yeah,
they can actually lose against us and still, you know, maybe catch Scotland off in the last game of the group.
Well, they'd have to fancy their chances against Scotland. If Scotland play the way they did, which they won't ever do again.
Well, I don't think so. Though in a way Japan have maybe a score to settle with Scotland, because in the last World Cup they had to play Scotland very shortly after playing against South Africa.
That was unfair,
a bit unfair in them. I was just looking at Neil Francis, and he was reminiscing about playing against Japan twice in World Cups. And what he said was, you wondered when they would ever kick the ball, and he threw in a little bit of language there. And he said, they don't kick to touch, they keep the ball in play for long periods of time, and their fitness and skill levels can cause problems for anyone. He says, most teams think they can bully Japan and are surprised at how resilient they are, and despite their lack of size, how willing and brave they are in contact. So he likewise is showing them a lot of respect and saying that don't expect that you can sort of hit them one sort of hammer blow. And knock them out. You know, they will keep coming back.
So, prediction.
Well, I think Ireland will win it. I think Ireland will control the game. and will have done their homework. It'll be important, I think, for Ireland to start well and to stay ahead and keep the standards high. No dropping of standards. I think if there's any dropping of standards, we could be in trouble.
We could be in trouble with them. Absolutely. Yeah. And we also have... What's the other big weekend game?
Well, yeah, the other big game this weekend is Wales against Australia on Sunday. So that's really one to watch out. That will, you know, probably decide the winner of that group.
Yeah.
And so the advantageous position in for a quarter final, yeah.
And you fancy Wales?
I do fancy Wales. I think they're Australia have always, almost in all of Warren Gatland's 10 years in charge of Wales, Australia has been their bogey team.
Yeah.
They found it very hard to beat Australia, but they did beat them the last time they played, and I think they're just, I think they're more organised. And Australia are flashy, but not as not as complete a team as Wales.
Yeah. So I fancy Wales to do it. So impressive. They're very much our bogey team at the moment, though we'll say England are doing a pretty good job being that as well at the moment. Steve Johnson, thank you so much for talking to us this morning, and maybe we'll have some good news to discuss on Monday.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.